This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. For an interview with Joel Covell, candidate for the Green Party presidential nomination, and Robert Letterman of Artist. Artist responds to illegal state tactics. We talked with Joel Covell, candidate for the Green Party presidential nomination, during a campaign trip to Nevada City, California. You're running for the nomination for the Green Party for president.
That's right.
Why are you doing that?
To show people that you can ask for very fundamental change within the confines of a presidential campaign, to thereby to lend power to the arguments that I'm advancing, to open up dialogue.
Certainly some of the changes that you are talking about are very, very fundamental.
Right. Yes.
In essence, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe from some of the things that I've heard you say, in essence, you're advocating for a socialist, if not communist, economic system?
Something post-capitalist, anti-capitalist. I think the time has come when you can begin to reopen this question of fundamental change and overturning of the capitalist system. Socialism is the best word I know of to signify that. I think what's exciting about our time is that this question is now reappearing politically and that it's now taking a specifically ecological form, and that's what makes this qualitatively different. This is not what I would call first epoch, but second epoch socialism. The fact of the matter is the capitalist system is driving the world to destruction. It's eating the world. It's like a cancer, and we should learn to see it as such, particularly as it's achieved its globalized status. And it's calling forth global resistance. What I'm running to say is that the Green Party should be an integral part of that resistance.
Certainly your major competition, if you will, is going to be Ralph Nader.
That's right.
How do you compete for the candidacy, for the nomination, with someone with the name recognition of a Ralph Nader?
Well, no, it's not easy, but, in one level, I'd be thrilled to get that nomination. I'm working for it. But whatever I do is to the good. I mean, I see, in a sense, Nader and myself additive. I mean, if I can get out and make a statement and affect people within the primary campaign, that's pretty much the same as running, full time. Obviously, one wants more and more. I do think there are some differences between myself and Nader that should be underscored and emphasized so that the Greens and people everywhere can weigh them and make the proper choice. But, Nader and I are both in the same general pathway. We're both running against, the system. I'm trying to run, I think, in a more fundamental sense than he is, but we're both in that same direction. So in that sense, our campaigns are additive. I have this little slogan that I'm not running against Nader, I'm running against Tina. Not Tina Turner, but the Tina that Margaret Thatcher enunciated, there is no alternative, T-I-N-A. And that's the big demon that we have to lick. That's the monster we have to overcome, this kind of enforced passivity, this inertia, this acceptance which has been foisted on us that the given system is the only possible one.
Certainly there are any number of people who consider themselves to be supporters of progressive politics,
yeah,
who then say, well, gee, if I vote for Joe Covell, oh my gosh, somebody like McCain's going to get in.
Oh boy.
What do I do? Oh, I guess I'll have to vote for Al Gore. I mean, you're laughing. I'm laughing too, but a lot of people do that.
Oh, I hear that all the time. I ran for the U.S. Senate in New York State in 1998. I got trampled by a herd of liberals panicking that they might reelect Al D'Amato. And instead, they all came up and said, Joel, I like what you're saying. But I can't afford to have D'Amato. And I kept saying, listen, friend, Schumer is in many ways worse than D'Amato, which he's turned out to be, by the way. But that's not the point. The point is to cut loose from this corrupt, death-dealing system. It's a matter of fundamental existential courage. Now is the time to say, no mas, the system has proven itself bankrupt. I mean, what more evidence do you need than the recent administration of Clinton Gore? I mean, it should be a no-brainer that there's no fundamental choice between these two parties, and that the only choice choice is to break loose of them.
I'd like to go back, if we can, to the issue of economic policy and theory, if we might. It seems to me, and perhaps I'm wrong, correct me if so, many of the people who I talk to who are supporters of the Green Party are fairly well-to-do, upper-class, liberal types. Are these people really going to be willing to support someone who is, in essence, going to say that we need to abandon private property?
Well, it's a free country. But the larger problem is that the Green Party has to reach out. Yeah, and the Green Party should speak for the whole world. Green Party is a party in 80 countries. It's the largest political party in the world, which is an interest. It's also this, you know, it's tiny in every locality, but it's everywhere. No question that it tends to be a party that's centered around environmental protection, and that draws in a certain number of moderate, well-heeled people. But some of them are quite conscientious about change. But whatever they think, our job, which is not doing nearly as well as we should be doing, is to begin to reach out to wider constituencies. You know, one way to do that is to make sure that we have social justice built into our platform and not just environmental protection. And in particular, we deal, for instance, with radical reform and overhaul of the criminal system, the so-called criminal justice system, the prison industrial complex, the racist complex, that, you know, the racist behavior that goes, because that's where you draw in the, you know, the people of color and the communities of blacks and Latinos. Another way is to begin to make creative alliances with the radicals within the labor movement. This is happening. It began, you know, certainly Seattle was the Seattle demonstrations was an example of that. In my platform, the labor planks are drawn from the Labor Party's platform. We are working with the Labor Party. Tony Mazzacci, the sort of the guru of the Labor Party, will be speaking before the Green National Convention in Colorado in June. So these things are happening, but you're absolutely right. I mean, the Green Party cannot be just a bourgeois party that wants a cleaner environment so that we can enjoy our, you know, well-earned or ill-earned gains, whatever. Enjoy that lifestyle to which we'd like to become accustomed. It should not be a lifestyle party. Okay.
Let's say that Joel Covell gets the Green Party nomination for president, wins the election, and goes to Washington. How does Joel Covell, as Green Party president, work in that system?
Right. Well, of course, that will not happen absent building of major social movements. And so that what Joel Covell will do under those circumstances is turn immediately to the base, the people that put me there, and begin to empower them and to draw them into the process. I mean, the president has fantastic, enormous powers of mobilization, of getting the word out, of being the bully pulpit and sort of thing. The last good president we have is FDR. You know, that's kind of what he did. That's a great ideal to aim for. I would, you know, immediately convene all kinds of national dialogues or, you know, debates to talk about things like, well, what do we really need to do about global warming? What do we really need to do about, you know, prisons or what do we really need to do about trade or socialized medicine? So actually start really immediately empowering the citizens' movement, because it's the social movements in the long run that are going to do it. To put it in the converse, if there was some kind of a fluke or a lottery where I would be parachuted into the White House, you know, and here you're president, sir, what would I be? If I tried to do these things, I'd be shot. You know, I mean, really, the system erases people who try to do things like that. They tolerate this kind of dialogue up to a certain point. But there's a big struggle ahead, and you've got to mobilize masses.
How do we mobilize those masses? Yeah. It's one of those great questions that I keep asking everyone that I talk to.
Right.
I mean, we've got a great idea here.
Yeah.
How do we get people to back that?
I don't have the magic wand, I tell you. I mean, I've spent 35 years working at this. I've shared all the frustrations. I do believe that we're at something of a turning point. I believe that I'm fighting for the soul and the future of the Green Party as a transformative, you know, instrument rather than as just a sort of an honest, you know, opposition kind of thing. How do we mobilize the masses? We've got our work cut out for us. One way to mobilize the masses, of course, is to fight for democratic communications. That's a major thing. I mean, to fight for a constant expansion of the public sphere. We've got the possibility now of low-power broadcasting. And my wife, who works in these things, she was founding Paper Tiger Television and Deep Dish Television. You know, so I know this from the ground up. You know, we're working and getting satellites and things like that. We've got all some cards in our deck, you know, using the internet more, which is a tremendous asset. But you and I both know this is the $64 trillion question. You know, what are you going to do to overcome that inertia, that apathy, that fear? Fear of authority, the sedimentation of the economic, the educational system, the religious system, the family system, the gender system, all these things that inculcate, you know, passivity and illegitimate respect for authority, or respect for illegitimate authority.
Let me go back to one question, because I know you don't have a lot of time, because I know you have a number of engagements.
Yes, it's a big day, yeah.
You said something about... And I'm paraphrasing, fighting for the heart and soul of the Green Party.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the Green Party is torn sometimes between having a heart and soul and then also in danger of getting trapped in the cult of personality with its candidates. I'm thinking of Audie Bach, who kind of did what she did.
Yeah.
People have mixed feelings about that. And then also with adopting someone like Mr. Nader, who, in my opinion, let a lot of people down last time by the race.
Including me.
And myself, too. I'll be honest about that. In the race that he didn't run, it seems to me that there's a real major issue there for the Green Party itself.
The Green Party is a work in progress. A very young party, which is just a sign that the crisis to which it responds is rapidly evolving. I'm not sure where it's going to go. It's just because it has this destiny doesn't mean it's going to fulfill it. It's a matter of consciousness. It's very much a work in progress. It's hard to summarize all the complexities, but what I would say, you know, programmatically is this: the Green Party must not simply become another electoral party. It must be a movement-based party with an electoral arm. And the stronger the movement side, the more that we ally ourselves with the people in the street, with the, you know, the radical forces that take direct action, and the stronger we are in terms of genuinely sort of, you know, making international connections and so on, as against just simply focusing on putting Greens in office, then the better we're going to be in the long run. That's the battle that's going on in the Green Party. That there's a natural tendency to get excited about electing candidates because that's the most visible and clear-cut way you can make some impact. But by the same token, the electoral process in and of itself is very much a centralizing, compromising instrument. It brings people down. It's in some ways the graveyard of the radicals. We're repeating now the Fundy-Riallo split in the German Greens and the U.S. Greens. And that's what's being fought out. That's one reason why I wanted to run this campaign. I'm a Fundy Green, obviously.
Joel Covell, candidate for the Green Party nomination for president. Now we're joined by Robert Letterman of Artist. Artist response to illegal state tactics, to talk about the case of Amadou Diallo and the police state situation in New York City.
Amadou Diallo was a West African street vendor. Around 12 o'clock at night, a little more than a year ago, he was standing in the vestibule of his own building. Presumably he had gone out to get some food. A unit of four undercover white police officers pulled up. For whatever reason, they imagined that he looked suspicious. They got out of the car and approached him. According to them, he reached into his pocket, and within the next few seconds, these four officers fired 41 shots at Mr. Diallo, hitting him with 19 shots. As it later turned out, he had no weapon. He was trying to show them his wallet. He was not a criminal. He had no criminal record whatsoever. This created a huge controversy in the city. And the reason that these police officers, these white police officers, were in this predominantly black neighborhood is really at the heart of this whole issue.
Talk, if you will, about that, because I know that you've been dealing with and confronting and also attempting to let people know about Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's police state tactics for quite some time. And I mean, I think that's where we're going here, correct?
Right. The unit that these four officers belong to is called the Street Crimes Unit. And basically what they do is go into high crime neighborhoods and do relatively arbitrary stops and searches. Various investigations that have gone on about this unit have turned up the fact that they've illegally searched more than 100,000 black males in this city in the past couple of years alone. Now, in the course of making these searches, there's no question that they did retrieve a few hundred guns. They found some small number of people that had a warrant for their arrest. The vast majority of these stops and searches resulted in no arrest at all and involved completely innocent citizens who were just going about their business. Now, if this same street crimes unit was operating like that in a white neighborhood, let alone in a well-off white neighborhood, it would be an unbelievable outcry from the citizens. There would be countless lawsuits, and the mayor would basically have been removed from office for violating the Constitution. This unit doesn't operate in white neighborhoods. It virtually exclusively does this practice in black neighborhoods, and there's no question that some of these neighborhoods have a lot of crime. But the issue comes down to the idea that, do you want to stop crime by criminals by creating a huge wave of crime by the government? And there's a tremendous sense in the minority community in this city that there is no equal protection, there's no equal rights, and there's no civil liberties for them under Mayor Giuliani.
We're talking with Robert Letterman of Artist, Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics. Of course, Mr. Diallo is shot and killed, murdered, as many would say, in the vestibule of his apartment building. A case is brought, and then that case is somehow or another transferred to Albany, New York, as compared to being tried in New York City, correct?
Right.
Talk, if you will, about what happened regarding the prosecution of the case of Amadou Diallo.
Well, this shooting took place in the Bronx in a mostly black neighborhood. There were tremendous demonstrations after the shooting in the city, and when the case finally came to trial, the defense argued successfully that it was impossible for the four police officers to get a fair trial, not only in the Bronx, but in New York City. So the case was removed from New York to Albany, which is the capital of New York State, which is a city that, unlike the Bronx neighborhood where Mr. Diallo was killed, which is probably 90% black, Albany is probably 90% white. So this alone gave a tremendous sense of injustice to many people here in the city. And then as the trial proceeded, now, I've been a defendant in quite a few criminal cases. The mayor's had me arrested 41 times. I've seen a lot of trials up close and been involved with them. In my personal opinion, and that opinion is shared by a tremendous number of lay people and commentators and even lawyers in this city, the prosecution was extremely weak. The four officers were barely even cross-examined. Witnesses for the defense were not cross-examined at all. And in the final analysis, the judge went to tremendous lengths to emphasize to the jury the police officer's side of this issue, being that the bottom line of what that came down to was that if these officers believed, no matter how unjustified they were in that belief, that they were in danger, that they had a right to defend themselves. Even if it turned out that Mr. Diallo wasn't a criminal, wasn't wanted for any crime, didn't have a weapon, and in fact didn't do anything threatening toward the officers. Now, personally, I can understand that as a legal aspect of the case, and if I was myself a defendant in a murder case, I'd certainly want every protection of the law, and I would certainly want the judge to instruct the jury in a way that would give me the greatest benefit of the doubt. On the other hand, based on what happened in this case and the judge's jury instruction, virtually any police officer could shoot to death any person in this country for no reason whatsoever and then claim that they felt threatened, that the man reached into his pocket, that the woman reached into her purse, that somebody made a sudden move, and get away literally with murder. So there's a tremendous sense of outrage and injustice, anger, and also fear in this city that if this is going to be a precedent for the police, that nobody is safe.
We're talking with Robert Letterman of Artist Response to Illegal State Tactics. Robert Letterman is joining us from New York City today to talk about Amadou Diallo. And in fact, many things that have gone on under the regime of Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in the Big Apple. Robert, the killing of Amadou Diallo and the number of arrests of persons such as yourself, and as I had shared with you via email, you had written a philosophy of Rudy Giuliani, which was published on Sam Smith's Progressive Review website. All of this, I mean, really ties into and is really spearheaded by the mindset of the mayor of New York who would like to be a U.S. senator, correct?
If not U.S. president.
That's even more scary.
As a matter of fact, people in his own campaign have told me that his real hope is that if George Bush is elected, that Giuliani will be appointed U.S. attorney general. And this is much closer, actually, than the Senate to what his ambitions are. He used to be number three man in the Reagan Justice Department. In an interview on Larry King Live just last night, the mayor admitted that being involved in the Justice Department was his highest ambition throughout his life. So there's very good reason to believe that the Senate campaign that he's involved in is, from his own point of view, nothing more than a platform to some other position. And if this man were to become U.S. Attorney General, rather than simply being in charge of district attorneys and police in New York City, he would be in charge of every police officer in the United States, every district attorney in the entire United States. And that is truly a frightening thought.
This is a person who has made statements that, in essence, people who are homeless and have no other place to sleep are criminals, and in fact has ordered these people to be arrested. As I know you and I spoke a couple of years ago, a person who has tried to pressure and arrest and frighten and intimidate artists such as yourself, street vendors such as Amadou Diallo, to sweep them off the streets of New York City, turn those concessions over to big corporations. I mean, this is a guy who really sees himself as some sort of attack dog against the poor and working class. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'd certainly agree with that, and I would also, though, emphasize that everything that Mayor Giuliani does is part of a very carefully thought-out strategy. It's not simply that he's tough on crime or that he's even tough on minorities. All of his policies are done for political effect. And in fact, probably the greatest, the most incriminating thing that you could say about this street crimes unit, rather than what I would say about it, is to look at the fact that the actual commander of the street crimes unit had warned the mayor and the police commissioner that a tragedy like this was inevitably going to happen because they were putting these young, very poorly trained white officers undercover into these black neighborhoods with the assignment, basically, of confronting people. you know, nobody has any problem with the police going up to somebody that's committing a crime or that's a suspect in a crime for some actual reason that they happen to be a suspect. It's quite another thing to simply randomly go through the neighborhood and search every black male that you happen to run into. That's not police work, that's police state work. And the mayor had been warned by not only the commander of the street crimes unit, ex-police commissioners that he had fired had also warned him that this was a tragedy waiting to happen, and it's actually amazing that it hasn't happened more frequently.
There have been a number of protests in New York City, as well as other cities around the country, I might add. What's the state of affairs amongst the people, as you can tell us, in New York City now?
Well, there have been hundreds of arrests since this past Friday when this jury verdict was first delivered. The police have been described as being quite restrained, although many of these arrests were basically people had stepped off the curb or something, and then they were arrested for disorderly conduct. In fact, even a number of lawyers that were acting as legal observers of these protests were also arrested. But there's a tremendous sense of outrage in the city, not only among minorities. There's a very large percentage of the demonstrators are middle-class white people that are also outraged by this. But I would say that the difference between the demonstrations that are taking place now and the ones that took place when Mr. Diallo was first shot is that the earlier demonstrations were focusing very strongly on the four police officers. Well, now that those officers have had their trial and been acquitted, and even though most people in the city, they just did a survey today that over 60% of New Yorkers don't agree with the verdict, but be that as it may, that trial is finished. What people are focusing on now in these demonstrations is Mayor Giuliani himself, and that's actually a good thing, because certainly from my point of view, even if those four officers had been convicted of the maximum charges and had been sentenced to life in prison, that wouldn't really address the problem here. These four officers shot an innocent man, but the issue is that the mayor, for political effect, to create statistics that he can then go on various TV shows and travel the country showing charts and graphs that purport to represent a crime drop that he claims to have caused, he is committing hundreds of thousands of civil rights abuses in this city and alienating and driving the races even further apart. Black leaders, white leaders, everyone in this city can agree that the racial relations are at an all-time low in this city, and that it's Mayor Giuliani that's personally responsible. You can't really blame black New Yorkers for feeling that white people are their enemies when they see that I'm a white guy, I'm middle-class person, I go out on the street, I'm never stopped by the police simply for walking around. Any black person my age, particularly if they're male, can tell you that they've been stopped 5, 10, 20, 30 times. If they go to the store to buy a newspaper, chances are they're going to get thrown up against a wall and searched by the police. So you can't blame people for feeling that they're being singled out, they're being targeted, they're being humiliated, and you can't blame them for being seriously angry. But at least now, a lot of this anger is beginning to focus on where this policy is coming from, which clearly is not from the police officer in the street, who in a way is also a victim of this policy. The police have never been as unpopular in New York City as they are at this time, which is rather strange if you consider that there's been a tremendous drop in crime. Clearly the police have something to do with that, certainly more than Mayor Giuliani does. You would think, since most people, virtually everybody, is against crime, that the police would be very popular now. But they've never been as unpopular, and it's specifically because of these civil rights abuses that Mayor Giuliani is ordering the police to carry out.
Robert Letterman of Artist, Artist Response to Illegal State Tactics. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.